people come back to this world and I think they find it extremely difficult to reconnect because that worldview has been changed fundamentally, both, you know, politically, morally, and from a values-based perspective. And then you have the community reject you and say, it's you, you're the problem, you're the one who's broken, you're the one who doesn't fit back in, you're the one who's angry, when it's possible, another alternative might be that maybe there's some things wrong with our communities. You know, the so-called normal people back here aren't perhaps that normal. And so, you know, maybe we should be trying to listen to what our returned warriors tell us about ourselves, rather than rejecting it.
Welcome to the Sam Gash podcast. These are conversations with trailblazers, rule breakers, and those who pave their own lane and venture boldly into the unknown. By entering this uncharted arena, they inevitably stumble, yet they all display an ability to innovate and contribute, even when the odds are not in their favour. We skip over their highlights reel and go into the guts of who they are and what they believe in. I'm your host, Samantha Gash, and I'm an endurance athlete, a former corporate lawyer, and social impact entrepreneur. It is my absolute privilege to create the space for these guests. If you found these conversations to be of value or have any feedback, please subscribe, rate, and review, and I hope you enjoy. Welcome back to the Sam Gash podcast. I've had a little break as I have been re-emerging from lockdown and quarantine, and for the first time in some time, I feel a degree of heaviness being lifted from my shoulders as I'm experiencing like the beauty of increased mobility. And whilst I say that, I still say it with the understanding that so many people in many parts of the world right now are back into lockdown and maybe facing battles of their own. So my thoughts are with you, and I hope this conversation you find to be helpful. This conversation is with Mark Matheson. He's a registered psychologist, and over the past 20 years, he has worked in some of the strangest, harshest, and least clinical environments on the globe. He has managed humans with their performance, with their potential, their risk, and their fragility, and when things don't go right. He's worked with the Australian military. He spent time working with commanders of special operation forces in Afghanistan. On a different perspective, he's debriefed wintering expeditioners for the Australian Antarctic program. He has designed and implemented local recruitment and induction programs in the Badlands of Papua New Guinea for oil companies. He's also established cultural change programs. He's assessed and recruited Indigenous youth into mining jobs in northwestern Australia. He has built resilience and grit programs for corporate groups, managed cast and crew on reality TV shows, which is where Mark and I first met back in 2017. He was the psychologist on set for Survivor, which was produced by Endemol Shine, and I was a contestant of. And Mark was there for the contestants in the lead up to that experience, during that experience, but also in their transition out. You know, Mark essentially helps individuals, groups, and organizations solve human problems. The problems are complex, that are adaptive, but also that may seem mundane to many people. This conversation looks at the values of returning warriors and how we should really listen to their insights and experiences. We discuss the consequence of a lack of purpose and clear strategy in the military, but also in the corporate arena. We discuss the stigma of mental health in the military and the challenges that are faced for him as a psychologist in that space. We look at moral injury, the impact of heavy deployment, the challenges to embed mental health programs in corporate environments. We look at his shift into reality TV, and we discuss broadly rites of passages across all the arenas in which he has offered his services to, his services of care. I hope you guys love this conversation. It's a unique one and it is so timely. Mark, welcome to the podcast. I am so happy to create space for you, you know, space for someone who so often is giving space for others and for us to get to learn about your experiences and insights. You know, and I was thinking about this podcast. You know, in this podcast, I interview people in the adventure space, and I define adventure so broadly. to include, you know, people who embark on journeys with an unknown outcome. So therefore, it includes entrepreneurs, academics, those in the arts. And, you know, what I try and speak to them about is what happens to them internally, to their minds, when they cross over from a space of what they do know to what they don't know. You know, how do they reduce overwhelm? How do they push past their previous boundaries, the limitations they place in their mind? And the reality is, you have studied the human mind for multiple decades. And I am so intrigued about, through all of your diverse experiences, what is common about the human mind in challenging scenarios?
Yeah, great question. And look, thanks for having me. You know, it's always always great to talk about these things, which as a psychologist, we sometimes don't get to. We get to do the job, but actually talk about it, you know, from a distance is always a novelty. But look, I think to answer your question, I guess there's two things I'd say. One is that, you know, people are remarkably the same. And no matter where you go or who you deal with, you know, I think we've all got these talents and capacities to use our mind and our abilities to, you know, achieve extremes. But the second part of that is that clearly not everybody is aware of that. You know, they're not living in that awareness. And so for me, the question has always been about, what's the turning point? When does that awakening occur, or how do people, I guess, come to the understanding that they have these resources that they can tap into and then use them? And I guess, look, the last 10 years of my career has been really trying to understand that. You know, I think we all have them, but not everybody clearly knows that they're there. And then how do you, as a, you know, a third party or as an individual, how do you tap into those resources becomes the question for me.
Yeah, I'm drawn straight away to like jump 10 steps ahead, because I'm really interested to know of, you know, have you started to be more aware of that, kind of moving away from the military lens where almost people are trained to compartmentalize, to be strategic in that way, versus the reality TV where you sometimes have just very, very normal people throwing themselves into a scenario they did not expect. But let's not jump ahead. Let's go back to the beginning, because, you know, your career, I mean, how many years were you based with the military?
So 22 years in, look, a lot of that was in the reserve. And look, that's quite common in specialty, you know, trades, because you're sort of put on the shelf and pulled off as required. So I spent the vast majority of that 22 years in the reserve, and then jumped into and out of full-time jobs as it suited me and as it suited the military, which I guess is the nature of the reserve now. So about 8 years in Special Forces, and then a couple of years towards the end in Canberra, kind of writing policy and working at that high-end sort of policy paperwork perspective, trying to change things within the culture of the Defence Force. Not very successfully, I might add, but that's another conversation entirely. Yeah.
Were you always compelled to work with the military when you were studying?
Oh, look, not originally. I mean, my background's actually in sports psychology, which is probably not that surprising. So I was a wannabe elite triathlete, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago when I was a young man, and was always into sport all through school and high school, and swam and obviously, you know, ran and did different things, and then ultimately fell into triathlon because it was a combination of those things. Was getting to the stage where I was kind of finishing in top 10, probably in my early 20s, and could see the sort of logarithmic extra effort required to get from top 10 to the podium. And, you know, just looking at what I was trying to balance at that point in my life, you know, uni, part-time work, you know, being an elite athlete, I just thought, well, something's got to give. And for me, it became the sport. I just thought, I don't have the time and the capacity to juggle these other things and achieve top 10. And so part of the reason I guess I fell into sports psychology was saying, well, you know, is it even possible for people to manage all of those things and still be, you know, quote, normal people? Or do you have to be somewhat abnormal to be able to reach that pinnacle. So I ended up sacrificing the sporting career, and it fell back into being sort of more recreational, and then went into sports psych. Found out through that study that no athletes in Australia have any money, they're all broke. So no one's going to pay for a sports psychologist because they're the most expensive and usually the last person you hire. And so, towards the end of my studies when I was doing my master's, was looking around, well, how the bloody hell am I going to make a living out of this? And looked for, I guess, allied areas where people perform at extremes. And initially I thought that would be the business world, but that was, you know, probably in some ways harder to break into, particularly as a young guy. Then thought, well, why not the military? I mean, the military is sort of an area that has high-performing people. And so I joined the reserves initially, actually tried to join Special Forces myself. And then I figured out through that I actually half blind in one eye, so I didn't meet the medical standards. And they said, oh, we see you're studying psychology. Would you be interested in serving in the military as a psychologist? Because in the Australian Army, it's one of the few militaries in the world that has uniformed psychologists. So fate determined that I serve as a psychologist. And then immediately made it my goal to get back into working with Special Forces as a psychologist in the military, and that took about 7 years. And eventually, yeah, got posted into Special Operations Command and got to put all those sports psych skills to use, I suppose.
Oh, I mean, you went through multiple selections, it actually sounds like, to get to that place. I've always thought the academic study process of psychology is the most challenging degrees, because at every threshold, like, the group gets windled down to, like, who's going to be able to be a clinical psychologist. And I just think it's so competitive. And I can straight away see, like, that correlation between those who do psychology can understand the sporting lens of willpower and competitiveness through, like, the inherent nature of that degree.
Yeah, and look, I think it's still growing. I mean, it's becoming more competitive, somewhat ironically. I mean, even though it's one of the highest output qualifications in Australia, it has been for the last 5 years. So producing more psychologists than ever before. You know, those that get to be sort of, you know, I guess the clinicians or the future academics, you know, it's an incredibly competitive process. I think I, you know, started undergraduate cycle with probably 300 other, you know, fellow students. And this is just at one uni, obviously. And there was three of us that finished a master's degree. Not at the same uni, but nonetheless, you know, that's sort of an indication of you got a, you know, 1% return. So, you know, there was a lot of people that exited along the way either because they just decided it wasn't for them or, you know, weren't good enough to get into the postgrad courses.
Man, have you read that book, How Bad Do You Want It? Mastering the Psychology of the Mind Over Muscle by Matt Fitzgerald?
Oh, look, I'm sure I do. I mean, if you could see me at the moment, there's about 400 books sitting behind me on my bookshelf. So I'm also one of these people that collects books and never actually reads the majority of them. I skim the chapter that I find the most interesting or bought the book for originally and then put it on the shelf and think, oh, come back to that.
This book kind of talks about, you know, there's very obviously different components what makes up an elite athlete and also, I guess, an endurance athlete. You've got the very obvious of, like, the biology-based, the training, you know, what you eat, and then there's, like, that component of willpower, and it's about kind of dissecting what it takes to have willpower to go past kind of your known or the comforts or to surpass discomfort, should I say. And I've just found it really interesting with psychology of an athlete, but also how it transfers, as you say, to, like, the corporate space and also how I'm trying to understand sometimes my husband, who is also in the SAS as well, because, you know, when you were with the military as a psychologist, you know, and obviously you spent quite a bit of time with the Special Forces, you know, with numerous deployments all around the world, what was your specific role with the SAS as a psychologist?
So, look, you're a bit of a jack of all trades as a psych and particularly so in the military, because, well, there's usually only one of you. So on any given deployment overseas, there's the one clinician or one psychologist who supports the entire contingent. So within the SAS, I would describe the role as you're a strategic human resource consultant. So your job is to basically provide the commander with strategic input in relation to the maintenance or enhancement of their human capability. And clearly within the special forces space, I mean, that's a pretty broad role, because a lot of what the special forces end up doing is, you know, operating within a kind of what we call a human terrain, or, you know, the human dimension of operations. So even if you're not necessarily, performing in that space, there's always a non-kinetic element to the operation. So how are we trying to shape or influence those people within the human terrain that we're operating? So in Afghanistan, we're obviously looking at the tribal elements and the tribal cultures that inhabit those places, and the history of those tribal elements. And so you're not just operating in a geographic space with, mountains and landscape and villages plonked around. You're also operating in a human terrain, which is, what's the history of this village versus that village? Is there, conflict, a history of conflict, and how far back does that go? And how might we as an operating force create an effect within that space that shapes that towards our desirable outcome? So as a psychologist, you're not only looking after the mental health of the soldiers, which is obviously a bit of a no-brainer. You're there to provide, basic kind of psych support to the soldiers and the capability within the barracks. You're also a consultant to the commander on how do they potentially use psychology to shape the terrain of the battlefield. So look, that on a day-to-day basis means, anything could walk in your door, like anyone or anything could walk in your door in any topic. And so you need to be able to kind of use some fairly basic principles of psychology and how humans operate to provide that strategic input back to the commander. They may or may not use it, but it's part of your brief is to be able to brief up on and provide recommendations about humans.
Did you feel it was a blend of like proactive and reactive?
Yeah, look, it's changing, as you can imagine, over time. I mean, as the military evolves as an organisation, and I guess becomes better at accessing and using the resources it has within it from a human capability perspective, we've seen that evolve. So if we go back to, 1999, when operations within the Australian military, kicked off again after a long hiatus, psychologists were very much seen as a reactive, band-aid dispensing mental health capability. So you were there to, if people broke, you were there to try and assess them and fix them. That was pretty much it. And as we've seen the capabilities in allied forces evolve, I guess there's been a little bit of a keeping up with the Joneses, and the Australian military has become more adept at using its consultant capabilities to create effects in the battle space. I don't think we're there yet by a long way. I mean, there's lots more that could be done, and a lot of that's based on, the personalities of individual commanders, how comfortable they are dealing with mental health capabilities and psychological capabilities, because some of them clearly don't like you. But it's becoming more of a formal capability in that broader sense over time. And look, the unfortunate side effect of operations like the Middle East is that we've had to get better at those things because we've needed to.
I mean, mental health is becoming progressively more understood, or at least it's not just so much we're going to, tack on a mental health arm to a corporate organisation. It's truly being, the stigma of it's being removed. But what would you say to even corporate organisations or sporting organisations who are trying to incorporate a mental health arm to what they do day to day? What would you suggest would be some of the ways of embedding that as opposed to having it as a tack on just because they feel like they need to?
Yeah, look, I think the biggest challenge I think we really face, Sam, in a lot of these spaces is that a lot of the time, and this is just my personal opinion, obviously, I think we're sometimes trying to force a round peg into a square hole or vice versa. I can never remember which way it's supposed to go, but you get the gist of what I'm trying to say. And yeah, that is,
totally.
you know, there are a lot of businesses, and I'll focus specifically on business because it's the most obvious. And look, the military is not that far different. But there are a lot of businesses that obviously have as their primary goal profit. And that's written into the constitution of most proprietary limited companies in Australia, and that the primary mission of the board of directors is to maximise the return on investment to shareholders. That's what a company is by definition. It's an organisation that maximises the return to shareholders. So directors are legally bound to try and achieve that. Now, obviously, the difficulty there becomes that if you're looking at something like the mental health of your workforce, obviously, up to a certain point, spending money, time, and effort on that is a good return on investment. It obviously, you know, increases engagement, increases productivity. It does all of those things that we know it does in terms of improving the business. But there are still, I'd say, a lot of directors in Australia, and not just Australia, but globally, who see that expense as one that they can avoid. They can say, well, there's nothing that says I have to do this. It's nice, and it's, you know, all well and good to have bean bags in the social recreation room, and I'm sure the employees like that. But I can't see, and nobody's forcing me to see, the link to profit in that expense. And so what I think is often the case in a lot of businesses is that we're quite immature in that sense. You know, we sort of turn a bit of a blind eye to mental health, or we make some tokenistic efforts a lot of the time, you know, to really try and tick that box to say, yes, we do have a, you know, duty of care or an obligation to do these things. But you know what? It's actually subtracting from our profit. And so we're only going to do so much before, you know, the expense becomes too much. And look, I'm not certainly saying that, you know, you can do this on the cheap. I think mental health within the workforce is an expensive proposition. But what it really boils down to for me and in my experience, it's at some point the board of directors has to make a decision as to where they value or how much they value that human capability. And if as an organisation they say, you know what, we're actually going to say we're a business or an organisation that genuinely cares for our people and wants to see them thrive or flourish as individuals, and we're aware and are making an informed decision that this may impact on our profit, then you tend to see some really good effective programs. But, you know, that still then begs the question, what if the shareholders turn around at the end of the day and say, well, you could have maximised our profit by not doing this or doing less of it? And so it becomes a values-based decision. And our corporate structures and our legal frameworks aren't set up, never were set up, to really maximise human capability or flourishing in a business context. The businesses were set up with a primary objective to make money. And sometimes that's going to come at the cost of the well-being of their people.
Have you got any examples where you've seen really great programs play out?
Look, the examples that you see most often nowadays are where businesses are set up as social enterprises, which is, you know, still fairly new in Australia. It's been around a bit longer in the UK and in the US. But a social enterprise is a different legal structure, still designed to, you know, maximise return, but rather than to shareholders, maximise return to a social ideal. And so there is a recognition, and it's a growing recognition, I think, in the business world that, you know, we can't just as organisations be about making profit, because we've seen the impact that that's had, not just, you know, on human capability, but on the planet. I mean, when you're a business that's, you know, BHP or Exxon or, you know, Rio Tinto, and your primary objective is to dig stuff out of the ground and ship it overseas and make money out of it, obviously you can run some great programs, you know, for different parts of your population, whether that be your workforce or perhaps some of the communities you're impacting or employing people from. You know, they return a lot of royalties back into Indigenous communities in Australia. But their primary objective is to make money. So, you know, the sorts of negative social impacts we see, you know, with some of these companies, you know, I think have played out, you know, pretty large on the mainstream media. I mean, making decisions around blowing up 46,000-year-old cave structures because it was, you know, the most cost-effective option to maximize and expand their mining capability, sort of smacks of, you know, a decision-making process that obviously is still stuck in that previous model of maximizing profit. Again, none of those directors did anything wrong. You know, you might say they did stuff morally wrong, but legally and, you know, from a corporate perspective, they were acting within the law and doing what they were expected to do and required to do by the corporation's law. But when you have a social enterprise, which is, you know, can do exactly the same thing, it can still mine stuff out of the ground, but when its primary objective written into the constitution is to then make a social return back into, you know, the people that work for the company or the Indigenous community, that's the primary objective. You get very different decisions being made. So we're starting to see some really interesting things happening within the business space, somewhat reactive because of what's been happening in the last 10 or 20 years. But, you know, that change is now occurring. So, you know, I really encourage people that are maybe listening to podcasts and check out what businesses do you interact with that are social enterprises? Do you even know what a social enterprise is and see what's happening in the corporate world, because I think we'll see more and more of them.
I think there has been quite an evolution of purpose-driven companies, and particularly if you think of millennials who are very much wired and connected to a purpose. And I don't just think it's millennials. I think, you know, the interconnectedness of the digital space and the evolution of like humans to now, people, we hear it. We hear the word purpose banded around more than we have ever before. In times like right now during COVID, a lot of people have felt in a slump because they feel like they haven't been able to attack goals that are kind of purposely wired because, you know, they can't think too far ahead. And so I think it's a really interesting space for companies that have been so focused on profits where they're not going to be able to retain their staff, particularly this new generation of the millennials, if they don't connect to them on a different type of level.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, you know, the big company, thank you, you know, the one that sells products in the supermarket, I mean, that's a great example. I mean, you know, a sort of a zero to multi-million dollar company because people can see writ large, you know, on the box they're buying, that this is a company that is about a social enterprise. Yes, it makes profit, absolutely, but it returns that profit into a different, you know, in a different way. Rather than going to shareholders, it goes back into communities, et cetera. And people are desperate, you know, in times like we're facing now, people are desperate to be part of something that is meaningful. You know, meaning is obviously individually determined, but, you know, we are hardwired fundamentally as human beings to do things that are meaningful and purpose-driven. And you can obviously take that in any direction. I mean, you can take it to, you know, be incredibly destructive, but if it's meaningful to the individual, then, you know, it can take many forms. And so I think we all would like very much to have those meanings defined in a positive light. But, you know, our culture has grappled with that for the last sort of 50 years as we've, you know, really maybe lost the plot a little bit. You know, we've headed off in this corporate bent around profit, and I think that is now being questioned. And COVID is providing a great format for that as well.
Yeah, and I think I've said a lot of times on this podcast, like I believe we're going to see a shift, move away from the I to the we. And I would say that like the previous decade has been quite I-centric, and I think that fits with that purpose. I mean, so there are that profit-driven model. And a lot of people used to say, well, you know, I'll just get through my work and then when I finish work, oh, that's what I'll do, my purpose-driven work, and I can have the security of my income to be able to do that. But I think there is, people are pushing back and going, why can't in my, you know, 9 to 5, 8 to 6, whatever it is, my day job, can I not feel that sense of purpose as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You don't stop being the same person just because you go to work, you know. Humans are humans and people are people. And look, an organization, capital O, is really just a group of people. You know, there's no physical thing other than, you know, maybe the buildings, but buildings don't do stuff. People do stuff. And look, I found this a lot in the military, particularly within the Special Forces community, because you invariably have a group of people that are extremely purpose-driven. And, you know, no doubt are still trying desperately to, you know, find meaning in the work that they do. And one of the common themes that I found in, you know, working with and debriefing these guys coming back from operations, particularly the Middle East, was that it became very apparent fairly early that the meaning in that mission had drifted. You know, it was never probably terribly clear. There was some sort of quasi-politico, you know, kind of geographic, you know, alignment with the US and the Allies, et cetera, to try and, you know, intervene in some quasi-ambiguous, you know, concept of weapons of mass destruction, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, there were a lot of soldiers who went over there, and I shouldn't say just soldiers, but, you know, aircraft men and women and Navy personnel as well, who figured out pretty early on that the meaning was primarily political. There was a lot of flag waving, and the actual, you know, operational and tactical sort of directives were pretty ambiguous, and you know, people came back quite disillusioned a lot of the time. At that bigger level, at an individual sort of team level, you know, it was about looking after your mates and doing the best job you could. But there was a lot of people, I think, scratching their heads, certainly in the latter half of that deployment, saying, just what the hell are we doing here? You know, why am I putting my life and my family at risk for what I really can't see as anything concrete? You know, it's sort of craziness. So I think, you know, I talk quite a bit about moral injury, you know, where we've obviously talked PTSD and trauma to death, you know, bad things happen in war. But broader than that, I mean, there's a genuine sort of disorientation and a shaking of people's moral fabric by going and doing these things and then coming back to a fairly sort of ambivalent community who didn't really understand either. And so you've kind of got these people that have gone and done this amazing stuff and risked their lives who've come back and gone, well, is that it? You know, really? I mean, I did all this stuff and what's it for and what have we achieved? And so, you know, I think that sort of requirement for things to be clear and have some clarity around meaning and purpose really enables people to achieve at their best. And when it's not there, bad things happen.
I mean, so you were there, you did 6 different deployments to Afghanistan, and mm-hmm. as you're seeing this increasing disillusionment, a disconnection from what the original mission was, lack of clarity, more people struggling and possibly, well, definitely mentally declining, like what are the repercussions of that?
Well, I think the repercussions of that we're sort of starting to see now, which are, you know, a lot of those people, well, I shouldn't say a lot, a reasonable percentage, and we don't really know, I guess is the hard part, but a reasonable percentage of those people, you know, have returned to so-called everyday normal life with a tear in their moral fabric. And unless that's kind of healed or at least, you know, repaired to enable them to kind of move forward with life, you end up with people that are kind of caught in this loop. You know, they're not able to reconnect back into their normal sense of selves. And the part of that is absolutely about the fact that people come back from operations, particularly places like Afghanistan, which is, you know, sort of counterinsurgency, fairly ambivalent, ambiguous sort of environment anyway. And you return to so-called normal life and realize that normal life back here is still kind of abnormal. I mean, people kind of live in this capitalistic kind of hedonistic world, the cult of I. And look, the unusual part of that sort of experience is that when you spend time in, you know, underdeveloped countries, you see people and have your world view broadened to the point where you can see that even though they might not always be people that you necessarily like, they're pretty happy with not a lot. You know, they sort of make do with what they've got, and they're often quite robust and resilient in a fairly blunt, brutal manner. And the kids are pretty happy, and, you know, most people love their kids wherever they are in the world. And you come back to Australia where, you know, people are arguing with their next door neighbor over whether they can put a second story on their house, or their kids are fighting over who's got the latest, you know, Sony PlayStation game. And so that hedonism and keeping up with the Joneses is writ large, you know, and I think that you can sometimes only see that. I talked a bit earlier at the beginning of the about, you know, people becoming awakened to, you know, I guess what's going on around them or their capabilities. And part of that is around meaning as well. You can derive meaning from things other than what, you know, modern society tells you should be meaningful. And it's not a nice car and it's not necessarily a beautiful home and it's not necessarily wearing the best clothes. Those things are lovely, don't get me wrong, but they're not things we ultimately derive much meaning from. And so people come back to this world and I think they find it extremely difficult to reconnect because that worldview has been changed fundamentally, both, you know, politically, morally, and from a values-based perspective. And then you have the community reject you and say, it's you, you're the problem, you're the one who's broken, you're the one who doesn't fit back in, you're the one who's angry, when it's possible, another alternative might be that maybe there's some things wrong with our communities, you know, the so-called normal people back here aren't perhaps that normal. And so, you know, maybe we should be trying to listen to what our returned warriors tell us about ourselves rather than rejecting it.
Oh, you've just described that in a way that I haven't actually thought. You know, it's so easy to kind of say that, you know, our veterans become wounded, which, you know, I really struggle to sometimes because it places them in a light that they have never seen themselves before. They've seen themselves as strong and capable, and then you have, you know, charities are doing amazing jobs, but they portray them as broken. But from what they've seen, they sometimes have insights into where we've lost our way.
Absolutely.
And so I've never heard it described that way, and that's actually really, it's really helpful for me actually. When you're seeing men and women struggling and declining in those environments where high performance is critical, potentially for the survival of not just yourself but also for your teammates, what's your role as a psychologist there on board? Like, do you kind of go to them if you see it, even if they haven't approached you, or like how do you balance that?
Oh, look, again, it's a bit of a, you know, there's an element of needing to be invited, I think. There's still, in my eyes, you know, so much stigma associated to talking to the psychologist that, you know, we as the clinicians need to be extremely careful about intervening in things because we have to countenance the impact that even something as simple as us, you know, walking up to and talking to a soldier in, say, the mess environment, which is the eating environment for your listeners, you know, which is a public setting. So if the psych comes up and sits down next to a soldier and goes, "G'day, mate, how are you going?" It could be the most innocuous thing in the world, but there'll be 100 set of eyes on that conversation and 100 set of, you know, in ways that that's being interpreted. So it does mean that a lot of the time you kind of have to watch and I guess try and look for those micro moments where you might be, you know, relatively private space where you can, with a degree of kind of innocence, bump into somebody and have a fairly innocuous conversation that you hope might lead to them coming and wanting to continue that conversation. So that's the kind of informal stuff. There's definitely a formal element to it where a commander or a senior member might say, "I need this person to be assessed by you." That's part of the job. But normally that's well down the path when somebody's, you know, pretty seriously struggling and it's become apparent to all that that person needs some support. But obviously, you know, trying to be proactive means tiptoeing around a lot of the time because the stigma and the kind of where we're at as a community, particularly so in the military, is not there yet. We don't see it as, you know, a coach coming up and trying to give some performance advice. We don't see it as a physio trying to go up and talk about technique or how to improve, you know, the physiology. The minute a psych gets involved, it's bad news.
I mean, this is a personal question from like what I've heard from Mark. Like he said that he knew that he had PTSD after his first deployment, and then he goes back three more times.
Mm.
What's the psychology of these guys that, and I've heard it from a lot of them, like that they just kept going back, even though they probably deep down knew that they were breaking a bit.
Mm. Oh, and look, I'm sure you know of plenty of athletes that continue to race or perform whilst carrying a physical injury, you know, because obviously, you know, sometimes our livelihoods depend on these things. You know, there's an expectation that if you, you know, can't race in the next race, that you may, you know, lose out on some income, or you might have sponsorship arrangements or deals that, you know, need to be fulfilled in order to, for the money to keep flowing. So there's certainly that part of it. But I think, you know, fundamentally, particularly when it comes to mental health, it's the fear that acknowledging, you know, difficulties or disadvantages or mental injuries will be career ending. That it's not just that you, I guess, you know, have to heal from those things. And we all know that, you know, healing from, you know, mental health often takes longer than a physical injury. So there's the fear of being out of action. But everybody, particularly in these environments, is well aware of the stigma and the judgment of the rest of the team. And look, warfare is fairly unique in that, you know, people are well aware that the decisions of everybody else in the team can result in people dying. And so when you've got that pressure of expectation that, you know, you don't want to ever be seen to be the weak link that might put the rest of the team at risk, you've kind of really only got two options. One is to admit that you're struggling and to step out of the team completely, because you won't want to be the person who carries that mental illness into the next firefight, because everybody's going to be going, you know, you're the guy that's going to let us down and get us killed. So you kind of have to make the decision to admit it and then step completely out of your career, your role, your personal identity, everything you've worked for, and hope to Christ you can recover from that and then regain the acceptance of the team as being fully fit and capable again. Or you hide it and you hope for the best. You hope that, you know, you can manage to get through it and you back yourself, which is what a lot of, you know, high-performing people do. They back themselves. I can continue to do this despite the injury. And so that's kind of where we're at with mental health, particularly in the military, is that you guys feel like they've only really got those two choices, which, you know, in a very pragmatic, performance-focused environment, they're pretty real takes on the situation. You know, people at this stage, you know, we don't deploy military personnel overseas with a currently active psychological injury. We don't do it. So if you've got one, you know that if by admitting it, that's what you're kind of signing up to. You're signing up to probably going home and probably spending a long time either trying desperately to get back into a special forces unit or doing something else with your career.
I mean, there's so many questions coming out of that. The first one is, do you not think that there can be a blend? I mean, of course these guys are going to have some kind of mental health challenges. Even if they don't have PTSD, there's going to be some kind of scarring from even just one deployment. And mm-hmm. These people were doing multiple deployments, particularly in the Middle East. So they, even if they weren't kind of far gone, I would be hard-pressed to imagine that the majority of them weren't kind of going through some kind of strain. Was that not kind of known?
Yeah, of course it's known, but it's obviously that situation where you put 100 guys in a room and say, put your hand up if you're struggling with mental illness. I mean, no one's going to put their hand up.
No.
They might come to you one-on-one, you know, if things are really getting bad, but we're just not there yet. And I guess I wonder if we'll ever get there. You know, is it realistic to expect people to do that? I'm not so sure. I don't know if we'll ever get to that point. I mean, you probably find that if we ask the same question about a physical injury, there'd still be a reasonable percentage of people that would kind of, you know, hide that too.
But then if there's the acceptance that yep. they're all going through kind of something,
yep.
But maybe they can still be high performing because they are trained to be that way. Like I've always said, you know, like surgeons, when they, you know, are in surgery, they're probably not always feeling 100% mentally or physically. You know, there's stuff that goes on into their life, but they can to a degree compartmentalize sure. because they're trained to do so. So I'm guessing if there's the right types of programs, mental health in play,
yep.
That coincide with their combat and their deployments, then you could be protecting these people while still allowing them to do the job that they're trained to do. So the acknowledgement that this is a reality is probably, I mean, maybe that can be the blend.
Oh, for sure. And look, if you look back historically, you know, culturally, We've known that military personnel are fundamentally changed by combat for thousands of years. It's not anything new. I mean, humans have been fighting for forever and probably continue to fight forever. So really, this sort of period of time where we're looking at it through a lens called mental illness, it's just a passing fad in many ways. But look, I fundamentally agree. I think to expect people to go into warfare and to expect them not to be fundamentally changed is naive. I mean, there's just see some things and experience some things that no matter who you are, no matter what training you've had, you will be changed. And I use that word intentionally changed because I think that one of the problems we have at the moment is this lens that talks about mental illness. That if you see something and you experience something that is a potentially traumatic event, that you somehow are lesser. And what we tend to have ignored in a lot of that, you know, coming back to that conversation we had about people coming home, is that maybe sometimes they're more, that the knowledge may not necessarily be positive knowledge, as in, you know, it's stuff that you would happily trot out at a kid's birthday party, but it's nonetheless an understanding and a knowledge about humans that is, you know, should be valued. And historically it was valued. We had lots of rites of passage and cleansing ceremonies for people returning from battle that were designed to normalize those experiences and to acknowledge the unique knowledge, skills, and abilities that returning warriors had and the role they had to play in communicating that articulately and carefully back into the communities. Because it's often, you know, if you think about events like the end of World War One and World War Two, there was clearly a desire, a global desire, not to enter into warfare again. It was bad and we wanted to avoid it at all costs. And it appears to me that, you know, it sort of takes a couple of generations for that learning to be ignored again or to be forgotten or to not be translated. And guess what? You know, we go back into a period of conflict again. So, you know, there is a role which has become undervalued for returning warriors to communicate and articulate, perhaps, if you want to use the word, the horrors of warfare or the bad elements of warfare into their communities, and for that to be accepted and acknowledged, and for soldiers and military personnel to be respected for carrying that burden for serving their country, that we've forgotten. We don't do that anymore. You know, people come back on an airplane, they're back home within, you know, 24 hours. And then it's kind of like, well, you know, just crack on with your job. And part of that, I think, is the corporatization of the military. It's gone from being a, you know, unique, cherished, valued, somehow fundamentally different role to being another job. It's a job that people have and it's a career and, you know, all of the bad things that have happened around people's careers and mental health is because we have this expectation that they will continue to serve, they will go on with their career and get promoted and get a hot pay rise. And, you know, it's become very much like a corporate job. You know, you don't get your, you know, MSBS payout unless you've done your time and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, whereas, you know, often people had a finite kind of, I wouldn't say lifespan, that's the wrong word, but, you know, period, they would only serve in one or two conflicts and then that was it. You know, that was unheard of for them to do six conflicts, certainly within a six-year period. And, you know, maybe we're expecting that we can train people to be resilient to points that are simply not possible in the military. So, you know, I worked at the end of my career in writing mental health policy in Defence Force. And the very clear message was, you know, do anything you humanly can to keep people in the military and to protect them from these mental health. And, you know, they came up with multiple programs around resilience and grit, all good things, but they fundamentally ignored the fact that, you know, people probably shouldn't be doing this level of, you know, deployments and that to realistically expect them not to be fundamentally changed by that. to somehow go back to a baseline at the end of it, and that would be the only acceptable outcome from a mental health perspective, I think it was naive.
On a policy perspective, that positioning from you, do you feel it's been ignored?
Oh, look, I don't know if it's been ignored. I think it's probably sitting very uncomfortably. And look, because it requires a certain level of political acceptance that bad things happen in war, and that people are fundamentally changed, sometimes for the worse. And the current, culture within mainstream community, which is about, you know, staying young forever, being perfect, being able to recover from anything. You know, we've got the magic fix for all mental health concerns. We'll get there one day. You know, ignores the reality that people can be fundamentally damaged. And we don't like it. It's unpalatable. You know, it means that we'd have to accept, you know, that people are broken or you know, that we've damaged them in some way. And there's this incredible avoidance of liability. Imagine how much we'd have to compensate people for the damage that we do by sending them to war if only we'd accept that war was bad. You know, why does DVA fight tooth and nail to kind of, you know, make the hurdle requirements to prove a mental illness so hard? Because if it was set too low, you know, A, the government would probably go broke paying, you know, the huge amounts of compensation. And B, we'd have to admit somewhere along the line that a certain level of injury was to be expected.
Is there a lot of research done about, like, you know, the cumulative effect? You know, it's so individual, I'm guessing, but, like, is there some kind of standard of X number of deployments and X amount of time is going to create X kind of impact?
Oh, not in the sense of, you know, the sort of the calculation. I think the US is well ahead of us in terms of looking at things like moral injury and trying to reframe, you know, looking at, rather than looking at individual events, like PTSD is meant to be diagnosed for an individual event. But how do you then classify an entire deployment as a single event or multiple deployments? You know, can you get six times PTSD? You know, where does it, you know, what's the calculation? So, and of course, as you've said, I mean, a lot of that is based on individual factors. So we know, for example, that people's level of resilience is cumulative, you know, so you can build resilience over time by, you know, kind of repeated exposure and graduated exposure towards mastery of certain skills. So it kind of depends on where people are at. If you're a 21-year-old with no strings attached, does that make you more resilient? If you're a 48-year-old married with three kids, does that make you more resilient? And it's, you know, entirely sort of personal. But to answer your question, look there is some embryonic thinking around it. There's a couple of people that I guess are trying to pull those pieces together. But the complexities of the way we design research also don't allow us to step back and have these broader conversations. Because, you know, research in the scientific framework is about one hypothesis, you know, one independent variable, one dependent or two dependent variables, and we try and, you know, isolate it, put it in a laboratory and try and work out A plus B equals what. It doesn't really work very well in a deployed military circumstance when you've got individual factors, environmental factors, political factors, geopolitical factors, military factors, weather factors. You can't really tease it out.
And you don't also have the those who are being deployed freely giving up information, at least in the real time, and possibly not even in the reflected time afterwards.
No, not at all. And look, you know, these guys are surveyed to death. You know, everybody's well aware and trying their hardest to answer some of these questions. But the bit that's often lost is that, you know, we've been surveying these guys for 15 years now. They're just bloody sick of filling in surveys, you know, being asked, you know, not only are you asking me to go across and do my job in a high threat, complex, difficult environment, you know, and I know I'm going to fundamentally probably be changed for this, but now you want me to fill in a bloody survey every time I do it. So there's a lot of resentment towards, you know, the academic boffins, particularly from special forces guys, because they know they're lab rats. Yet they're not getting much back the other way. You know, there's nothing coming back to say, well, you know, we've come up with this magic solution that's going to protect you and your families from all these bad outcomes. It's just, you know, fill in another survey and it disappears into the vortex and never to be seen again. Somebody probably gets a PhD from it. but certainly doesn't come back and help me. And so, I mean, I was having a conversation with a researcher who was looking into this concept of moral injury, Australian researcher. There's only about two or three doing research on moral injury in Australia. And she was saying, oh, you know, I'm wondering if you can put me in touch with some special forces veterans. I'm having lots of difficulty in recruiting people. I've got this 45-item survey that I'm trying to get completed so that I can, you know, it's like, well, stop, you know, that's your problem. You know, you've got no idea how many surveys and questionnaires these guys are being asked to fill in. So the kind of inability for the researchers to adapt to that environment is also part of the issue. You know, you can't progress the research, prove that things are evidence-based if you won't get participants to participate, and they're just sick of participating in research. So you're not going to get that either.
You recently provided some insights to an article that was published in The Australian that was written by Ben Packham. Can you speak to that?
You know, there's obviously the Inspector General ADF report, which is, you know, being investigated for many years now, and everyone's kind of waiting with bated breath for that report to drop about the culture and some of the incidents that occurred within Special Forces. And, you know, from all of the kind of tidbits of information that have been released so far, I mean, the outcomes from that report appear to be targeted, you know, at a small number of individuals. And one of the concerns I think a lot of people share, you know, within the Special Forces communities is that quite often when these investigations occur, and this is by no means the first, you know, a couple of individuals, usually fairly low down the pecking order, named and shamed, appropriately punished, and everyone kind of, right, you know, pushes the reset button, sits down, has a cup of tea, and then goes back to business doing exactly the same thing. Because really, as we all know, I mean, cultural change within these organisations, let alone defence, you know, has to occur simultaneously across the entire organisation from the top to the bottom. It can't just be, you know, punitively punishing or punitively dealing with a couple of low-ranking people, which looks good in the media, makes the ADF look like it's doing the appropriate things, which I'm sure it is, but it doesn't really fundamentally lend itself to cultural change. So part of the article that I was involved in and a number of other pieces, you know, both in The Australian and other sort of media outlets with other, I guess, people around the SOCOM community is to sort of try and shape some of the public perception and understanding of how these places operate and what might be some of the other contributing factors to why these events ended up occurring, if that's subsequently what's proven. And look, in my mind, certainly you cannot underestimate the impact of culture on individuals' behaviour, because culture is ultimately what drives people to do the things that they do in high-stress situations. You know, there's a set of values that are, you know, consciously or subconsciously held to be true, and they shape what is allowed and what is not allowed. And really the people that are responsible for shaping that culture are primarily the leaders. That's their job. You know, leadership is about not just setting a direction but sort of setting the criteria for how we're going to achieve that outcome. And so my article, or at least the article I contributed to, was talking a little bit about, you know, what are the precursors that we knew about in terms of shaping that culture. And in my mind, certainly part of that was, you know, and there was an understanding within SOCOM that fatigue, both, you know, cognitive and physical, was occurring. We didn't have hard data that proved that, but you didn't have to be, you know, a rocket scientist to know that people were getting tired after multiple deployments. And that was sort of exhibited through all sorts of, you know, behaviours, you know, incidences of, you know, marital breakdown, people taking time off and asking for compassionate postings, you know, support staff asking to be posted out of SOCOM early on some occasions, individuals who, you know, were tacitly known to be struggling, kind of being, I wouldn't say ignored by command, but certainly not having the issues addressed or direct questioning being asked. It was kind of just left in the uncomfortable, squirmy land of mental health, and we just won't go there. And so when you see a trajectory over time, And certainly part of the role of the psych is to debrief commanders at the end of every rotation. We collect data, obviously, like everybody, and you provide a verbal and written brief back to command saying, this is what we're seeing. And that report quite often disappears into the Canberra vortex, never to be heard of again. You can't help but sort of go, well, somewhere somebody knows this is going on and can probably see the same trajectory that I'm seeing and is clearly not doing anything about it. And I guess that's the piece that I was trying to contribute to that conversation, was to say, to pretend that we didn't know people were, you know, burning out, becoming dysfunctional, and that that wasn't most likely occurring collectively across the command, was at the, you know, at the best it was naive, and at the worst it was intentional neglect.
I think that information is really important to come out. You know, the world of the SAS, you know, the pressures that those soldiers faced, you know, what combat is really like, it's such a big unknown for civilians. You know, for us who don't live that reality, I think things can seem a bit more black and white, and it is helpful to get a small insight into the minds of the people that have experienced something just so beyond what we can possibly conceive, people who are serving their country and were placed in a truly extreme situation.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's all certainly my intent was, and as I know there's other people that are commenting as well, and just to say, look, you know, this is not as clear-cut as perhaps, you know, we'd like to think. That's an easy solution, and I'm not saying we should ignore those elements at all. You know, clearly if people have done wrong and if they've broken the, you know, rules of armed conflict, then there should be punitive actions taken. No one within the special forces community would say otherwise. You know, if they've proven to have done wrong things, they should be punished, as anybody in our community who does something wrong should be. But, you know, let's not be naive into thinking that, you know, these events occur in isolation, that some rogue individual just decides to become, you know, a bad person. Yes, that is a possibility, but, gee, it's pretty unlikely in my experience that the vast majority of time and effort gone into selecting these people would countenance against that in the first place. And we don't select bad people. We don't select psychopaths. We spend a lot of time, you know, making sure we're choosing, you know, robust, resilient, highly capable individuals to serve in these units. So how is it then that we get to a point where, if these events are proven, that that is tacitly allowed or, you know, ignored or covered up or those things? Now, that speaks to a much larger cultural trend and, you know, failures in other parts of the organisation as well as the failings of the individuals.
Oh, dead on, because there's probably no group of people that have been more tested to do their job than the people who are in the SAS. And, you know, mainstream public are getting a very small insight into that through, I guess, the televisation of, you know, SAS Who Dares Wins, which I know that you've worked on, and let's kind of like shift the conversation, because the second part of your, maybe third or fourth or fifth part of your kind of professional career is working as a psychologist, consulting with reality TV shows. So how did you get into that? How did you go, okay, I'm going to walk away from the military and now I'm going to go with a new group of people who are really going to put themselves in a weird scenario?
Yeah, good question. Look, it was a bit of a funny story, and ironically there's a military link, and that is that, you know, I sort of left full-time army in 2008 after a period of time in special forces and went back into the reserve and came back home to Melbourne after living in Perth. And I immediately got a job in the corporate sector. So I was working for big mining companies, mostly throughout Southeast Asia, doing sort of similar selection, strategic HR advice and consulting. Was a little bit disillusioned with that after a couple of years, not because it wasn't interesting, but just because, you know, it was kind of more of the same, but, you know, with a profit kind of motive rather than a military one. A friend of mine who was a GP and a doctor in the military rang me up kind of out of the blue and said, oh, look, my partner, now wife, you know, is a executive for a TV company, and we're looking for a psychologist to work on a new show coming to Australia where people are going to be in sort of remote, isolated, you know, quite difficult survival-based circumstances. And I immediately thought of you because, you know, there's not many psychologists that specialize in that. Would you be interested in working on a TV show? And to be honest, I kind of went, oh, God, TV. yeah, maybe, you know, because he was a good mate. I didn't want to let him down. And he said, look, just make up a quote, make it worth your while, send it in and they'll have a look. And, you know, you never know, you might kind of, you know, do well out of it. So I literally made up a quote and I costed in what I thought it was worth to my ego and my, you know, kind of, oh, gee, TV. And they accepted it. And I went, oh, okay, well, I guess I have to kind of do it now. And that was series one of Survivor coming out to Australia. So, and look, you know, reality TV and, look, a lot of TV gets a bit of a bad name. But at the end of the day, the people who go on the shows are people. And you know this, Sam, because you're one of them. You know, they're people yeah. and they've got goals and ambitions and they're not bad people by any stretch of the imagination. People like to, I think, characterize them sometimes as naive or silly or, you know, motivated by bad things or naive things. But people are people. And much like people, you know, have questioned me in the past and say, oh, how do you work with people in the military that may have done bad things? It's like, well, everybody deserves to be taken care of. You know, we have a system in Australia, a legal system that says, you know, if you do something wrong, you get punished, but then we kind of, you know, we accept that and we reintegrate you back into community and we move forward as long as you've learnt your lesson. And you know, people I've found across the globe and throughout different industries are the same. You know, if people want to go on a reality TV show, they still are entitled to be taken care of. And they're entitled to be supported and to not have that ruin their life. And so, you know, my experiences across a number of reality TV shows have always been that, you know, my job is to care for them, to look after them and to guide them through that process and hope them fully come out the other end, hopefully having had an amazing positive experience, but if not, that they're taken care of and supported and reintegrated back into their so-called normal life with as little, you know, trouble as possible. So whether it's a reality TV show or a military deployment, I mean, doesn't really matter to me. It's still looking after people.
Yeah, the concept is the same. And, you know, Mark sometimes, you know, has said to me that, you know, when you've got an off Survivor and he's chatted to some of the people who have been on the show, like the way that they're feeling, he goes, was the way that he felt when he came back from deployment. He didn't feel that coming off Survivor because it was probably far less of an impact than coming back from deployment. So he was attuned to that feeling.
Yep.
But for a lot of people, it's the first time they've felt anything like that. It couldn't be more far removed from their normal life. But and it's pros and, you know, I also never thought that I would have been on a reality TV show based on my past experiences in corporate law and even the work that I did in the endurance space. But, you know, there's definitely pros and cons that come from that experience. And like anything in life, it's how you choose to frame it and move forward with it and bring those experiences into the other aspects of your life. But, you know, right now I'm in yelling at the southwest coast of WA and we're here with Jared Singh. And it's so funny, like people that you share immersive experiences with, even what, you know, I wasn't even on the same tribe with Jared. We spent no time together really besides the challenges, but these people know you in a way that other people don't know you. And so therefore, like, you do become like this very odd collection of people who you could almost describe as a family because you've got this care for them. And it would be the same as in the military. I mean, those guys who are doing that show, Who Dares Wins right now and going through that kind of selection process, I can only imagine the relationships that they've formed with each other. What was that show like to be a part of?
Oh, look, very similar in many ways to most of the other shows. I mean, I tend to use a lens of looking at these experiences as a rite of passage. So there's a separation element. So you're leaving your known world behind, your, you know, familiar everyday life and your family, etc. So there's elements to that separation which can be handled well and not so well, and they need to be shaped. Then there's a challenge, you know, whether it's a physical challenge or a psychological challenge, often both. But people fail to acknowledge sometimes that it is a challenge to their worldview, and that if you move through that transformation, that you are fundamentally altered by that experience of being on. It's, you know, the fact that it's a reality TV show is irrelevant. It's that you somehow are challenged and you have to look within yourself to find whether you have the capacities and resources to deal with that challenge, whether it's a social challenge, you know, in case of survivor being, you know, booted off by other people, or whether it's a physical challenge, as some of the challenges are. And then there's a return. There's a requirement to then set a new direction, to take that knowledge and to return back to your community changed, you know, so you are fundamentally changed. You return back and has to be reintegrated in your new form. So for people on reality TV shows, you can't ever not be a person that was on a reality TV show. You know, you can't ever not have people probably ask you about it at, you know, dinner parties and so forth. Well, what was it like? Because they know that you've been initiated into that world. And so that's the bond that also brings you all together, the people that have shared those experiences. You know, I've got the badge that says they've been on a challenging reality TV show, and so you have a common bond, a common language, and a common experience. And you cannot pass that on to somebody else who hasn't been on the show. You can talk about it, and they can kind of sympathise with it, but they can never really truly understand. And that's no different from a military deployment or, you know, anything else that can be seen as a rite of passage. But to answer your question about the show, I mean, it clearly has all those elements. There's a separation. We take people away from their families. We put them in lockdown. You know, we cut off their communications with their families. There's clearly a challenge. In this case, it's the context of the, you know, SAS selection course. And it's always a case of whether they can meet that challenge to look within and decide whether they wish to continue or not, whether it's for them, whether they've met their boundaries or their expectations. And then there's a return. So, you know, we filmed about 2.5 months ago now, so those people have all clearly returned. And one of the complexities of working on reality TV is that people may return, as in they come home and go back to their families, but then there's this hiatus period where the show hasn't yet gone to air. And so they can't actually return wholesale psychologically until they're allowed to, you know, kind of talk about things, or their non-disclosure agreement expires, and so they can talk about that experience within a context. And so you do get some delayed issues with shows that aren't sort of, you know, rapid turnaround, where people kind of have to suffer in silence, and that can actually create some somewhat perverse outcomes for people sometimes, particularly if it was a bad news story, you know, if they got kicked off first and they really struggled with that, and then you can't actually even process it and talk about it for 3 months.
Yeah, I always said there's three experiences being on a reality TV show. It's the experience that you live in the moment. It's the reality of what you think that is once you've kind of been booted off or you kind of finish that experience. And that is a very personal, like in your lens, like everything in your mind is told through your perspective.
Yep.
And then you're seeing the version that played back, which most of the time it's got nothing to do with the way that you imagined that it would be. And so there really is three, because it's like 24 characters or there's 12 characters. So your perspective is just like a micro part of that, and often in not the way that you thought it would be kind of come out. So there's really three different moments of time that you have to kind of process through.
Absolutely.
What surprised you about people in general since you've kind of been working in reality TV?
Oh, gee, good question. I don't know if anything's necessarily surprised me. Look, I think one of the things I've come to notice, and it's, I guess it's part of my own, you know, personal set of experiences and the journey that I've been on as a psychologist, is that, you know, I need to be very careful of ensuring that my capacity to sort of have a set of expectations about individuals is constantly reset and recalibrated. I mean, I guess that's come from if you work with people, and I'm thinking particularly of the SOCOM sort of special forces environment, who function at the extreme right end of the normal curve, you know, the top sort of 2% of people cognitively, emotionally and physically, it becomes harder sometimes to be tolerant of the people that are back in normal land, because you want to kind of slap them sometimes and say, oh, you're capable of so much more than this, you know, just get over it. You know, I've seen people do amazing stuff and they're no different from you. And I guess, you know, that's a bias or a you know, a viewpoint that it's impossible for other people to have, of course, because unless they've been a psychologist who works in special forces, how on earth would they know that? So sometimes I have to be careful about, you know, not wanting to slap people.
That's such a good way of saying it, because for that person, that could be their first rite of passage. Whilst they might kind of fall short of their human potential in that moment, that could be the defining moment that expands them, or possibly, you know, retracts it as well. You never know how they're gonna take it. How has being a psychologist changed the way that you interact with people, even when you are not in a professional mode?
Good question. And it's actually one that I ask my so as a supervising psychologist, I train, you know, up-and-coming psychologists. When do you become a psychologist, and when do you, you know, stop being a psychologist? And I guess it's no different from any other career in that really the answer is never. And that is, you know, once you have that set of skills and knowledge and experiences, you can't really separate them from you as a person. It'd be like saying that, you know, Sam, you run, so you're a runner, yeah? So you kind of have all those experiences of knowing what running's like, you know, anaerobic threshold training and pain and discomfort and what it's like to run with, you know, tendonitis and all those sorts of things. You can't undo that. You can't turn it off. And so when somebody says to you, oh, yeah, look, I've been getting back into running and, you know, I'm just starting out doing 2Ks and so forth, you know, what's your advice or what are your thoughts? It's not like you change into a completely different person to answer that question. Yeah, you're just Sam, yeah? Sam who's got a set of skills and knowledge. And so you might pass on some tidbits of advice, but it's always going to be personal, you know? It's always going to be from your experience and your stories, yeah? So I think one of the misnomers, I'm going to use that word, misnomers that is bandied around about jobs like a psychologist is that somehow you step outside yourself and become this objective scientific person that's somehow able to view things through this perfectly calibrated lens. And that's, in my perspective, it's bullshit. You know, you're always a subjective, you're always a person first. You're always, you know, looking through the lens of psychology as a person that's grown up with your own set of experiences and your own knowledge base. So the lens is purely that, it's a lens. And, you know, you can interpret the same set of behaviours or the same pieces of data that another person is giving you in multiple different ways, but they're still always coloured by your own experiences. So I think that's a long-winded way of saying, you know, I think for me to be able to answer your question and say, you know, how has being a psychologist changed me, I can't really answer it because I don't know. Mm-hmm. I am a psychologist and I have been for 20 years, but really that's just a job title. What I am is Mark Matheson, who's had a certain set of experiences and has learnt some things at uni and learned a hell of a lot of stuff by talking to people, and that's all floating around in the mix, and I don't know which bits of it aren't just me and which bits of it are somehow this other objective psychologist person that, you know, doesn't really exist, if that makes any sense. Bit of a wishy-washy answer, but I think you could probably get what I'm getting at. It's that I don't go to a party and say, people say, oh, are you analysing me? Well, the answer, of course, is yes. I can't help but not do it, you know, because that's the way I've been thinking for 20 years.
I think that's a great answer. I mean, the guts of that is, like, of course we all bring to the present what we've experienced in the past. And what's in your past is that you've been analysing people for 20 years. And, of course, that's kind of how you move about your day. But it is, yeah, you're a human first before you are the profession. So I really appreciate having the time. Actually, I have to finish with this because I'll never forget when I got booted off Survivor. I was in that room where you do the drive, you're by yourself, you're a bit shell-shocked, and kind of eat some food, then have a lot of diarrhea, and then you rock up the next day. And in that time, your head's going crazy, going, oh my goodness, I didn't expect to get booted off. But, you know, did the people that I trust, were they betraying me? Like, that's kind of all you care. Like, you know, the people that you don't trust, like, it doesn't matter. But the people that you held closely to you, they're the ones that you don't want to feel like you were kind of sabotaged by. And I remember looking at you and I'm like, did I get made a fool of by Mark? because he was the only person that the producers ever asked me, going, so what's your friendship like with Mark? Do you trust him? And he's the only person I ever said, yeah, I trust Mark in the context of this game, you know, as much as you can trust anyone. And you just said to me, oh, I shouldn't be telling you this, but no, Mark didn't break your trust. You know, you guys were close. And it was almost kind of all I needed to feel like, okay, the person that I felt like I belonged to in that environment stayed loyal to me, so I can move forward. So I'll always remember you saying that to me. So thank you.
Well, look, I'm glad it was useful at the time. I mean, really, I think as you've probably tried to ask in a couple of different ways, I mean, the job of a psych is to just remind people of our humanity, and that, you know, when you take the humanity out of any of these roles, whether it be the military or reality TV, we really don't have any purpose in being there. I mean, that's really what a psychologist is. We're kind of the reminders that we're all human, and we all need sometimes just to be, you know, encouraged or loved or valued. And sometimes we forget that ourselves. So I'm glad it was good at the time.
I love that. I think that is a really great way to define a psychologist. Thanks again, Mark. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Pleasure.
Mark so perfectly said, we cannot underestimate the impact of culture on individuals' behaviour. Culture is what drives people to do things in high-pressure situations. I found this conversation so timely, particularly off the back of Mark's conversation with the fact that it's Remembrance Day, the importance of valuing our returned warriors as well as those that we have lost could not be a greater message to share today. I hope you guys found that to be of value. If you did, I would love for you to share the conversation. Of course, subscribe, rate and review. And I just hope that you are happy, safe and well wherever you are. We are facing challenging times, as we've discussed so many times on this conversation, but I do believe people are far stronger than they ever truly realize. But it is important to reach out and don't hesitate to reach out to those that are close to you. It's amazing what people will do if they know that you need them. I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation, tuning out, and look forward to bringing to you next week's episode, which will be with the incredible Rich Roll.